So, real quick before we get into the weeds today, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 65 course with like adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. You can check it out at certfuel.com. Okay, so let's just jump right in. Imagine you pay someone, let's say $1,000 today, for a machine that only spits out one single dollar bill every year.
Right, which sounds completely insane.
Totally insane. You'd be waiting, what, a millennium just to break even on your $1,000?
Yeah.
Yet investors in the stock market do exactly this, or at least variations of this every single day.
They absolutely do. It's a space where raw math just completely collides with human psychology, because what we're trying to do today is answer one single incredibly difficult question that has basically plagued Wall Street for a century.
Right.
And that question is this specific piece of paper, this stock, overvalued, undervalued, or fairly priced?
And look, if you are prepping for the Series 65 exam, this is not just some, fun philosophical debate you have over a beer. Mastering these equity valuation methods is your primary mission today.
Essential.
This specific topic is worth about four questions, which is roughly 3% of your entire exam.
Yeah.
So we need to know this cold.
Yeah.
But since you're already deep into your studies, we aren't going to insult your intelligence by just reading textbook definitions of an income statement, you know?
No, definitely not. We are going to dig into the actual mechanics. The test writers, they aren't just going to ask you for a formula.
Yeah, they're way sneakier than that.
Exactly. They are going to put you in a very specific scenario, throw some distractor data at you, maybe a lot of distractor data, and ask you to apply the right tool to the right problem. If you don't understand the underlying why behind how these tools function in the real world, those trick questions will absolutely catch you off guard.
Right, so to make this actually stick, to give you a framework you can recall when you're sweating under the fluorescent lights of the Prometric Testing Center, we are going to introduce you to a cast of characters today.
I love this.
Yeah, we've got three very distinct, very stubborn investors who view the market in completely contradictory ways, and they are going to anchor every single example we talk about.
Which is great because it grounds all this abstract math in actual human behavior. I mean, markets are just people, right?
Exactly, just panicking people. So first up, we have frantic Fiona. Fiona is a day trader. Imagine her sitting in this like dark, climate-controlled room, illuminated only by the glow of six different ultra-wide computer monitors.
Naturally.
She is highly caffeinated, probably drinking her fourth espresso of the morning, and she is absolutely obsessed with charts, short-term trends, and price momentum. She doesn't know who the CEO of the company is. She doesn't care if the company makes microchips or like novelty pet rocks.
She literally could not care less.
Right. She just cares about the squiggly lines flashing red and green on her screens.
So she's a classic momentum player, driven entirely by market sentiment. Then, on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, we have patient Pete.
Complete opposite.
Right. Pete is relaxed. He's a fundamental long-term investor. Picture him sitting in a comfortable leather armchair, sipping a warm cup of chamomile tea, and just slowly reading through a company's 200-page annual SEC filing.
Sounds thrilling.
For Pete, it is, because he doesn't care what the stock price is doing today at 10:30 a.m. He cares about what the actual physical business will be generating in cash 10 years from now.
Right, so we have chamomile tea versus quadruple espresso, the classic Wall Street divide. But wait, there is a third character.
Ah, yes.
Finally, we have Dividend Dave. Dave is an old school guy. He is practical, he is a bit cranky, and he utterly refuses to look at Fiona's charts or Pete's massive spreadsheets.
None of it.
Dave only cares about one thing: the physical, cold, hard cash checks hitting his mailbox every single quarter. If a company doesn't mail him actual cash, Dividend Dave isn't buying the stock, period.
So, frantic Fiona, patient Pete, and Dividend Dave. Those three represent the core philosophies of equity valuation that we have to conquer today.
Okay, so before we get into the heavy math, I want to ask you, the listener, a direct question. Just stop what you're doing for a second and think about this. If you had to guess how much a local business down the street from you is worth, what would you look at? Would you look at its past price history and how much people were randomly offering to buy it for yesterday? Or would you crack open its actual bank account and inventory logs to see what it fundamentally owns?
Take a beat and really consider the logic there. Are you trusting the wisdom of the crowd's pricing, or are you trusting the raw accounting data?
Because your answer to that question places you on one side of a massive fault line in the financial world. it dictates entirely what kind of data you even believe is relevant. So let's start over on Fiona's side of the canyon. This is technical analysis. Fiona has a core belief about the market that drives every single trade she makes.
Yeah, her entire worldview is basically built on a variation of the efficient market hypothesis. Fiona believes, down to her bones, that all publicly available information about a company is already perfectly reflected in the current stock price.
Meaning everything is baked in.
Exactly. Every piece of news, every earnings report, every lawsuit, every whispered rumor on some obscure internet forum, the millions of buyers and sellers in the market have already digested it, done the math, and priced it in instantly.
Okay, let's unpack this, because I have to push back on Fiona's logic right out of the gate. If the market is perfectly efficient and everything is priced in immediately, how do massive, totally irrational bubbles happen? Like, how did the dot-com bubble happen if everyone was perfectly pricing in the data?
Right, and that is the beautiful irony of technical analysis. Fiona doesn't necessarily believe the market is correct in its valuation. She believes the market price represents the true consensus of human emotion at that exact second.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so whether that emotion is deeply rational or a manic, euphoric bubble doesn't actually matter to her. If a stock is soaring because of an irrational bubble, she wants to ride the bubble. Looking at a company's financial statements is a complete waste of time for her, because by the time Pete finishes reading page 10 of that quarterly report, the market has already reacted to it. To Fiona, fundamentals are just old news.
So she is flying completely blind to the actual business operations. She is purely looking at historical price movements and trading volume, like how many shares are moving and in what direction.
It is entirely focused on the short-term mechanics of supply and demand. Technical analysis is simply the art of predicting future price direction based exclusively on past price behavior.
The analogy I always come back to here is driving. Fiona is essentially driving down the highway at 80 miles an hour, but her windshield is completely blacked out with paint.
That's terrifying.
Right. She is driving purely by staring into the rearview mirror, trying to predict the curves in the road ahead based solely on how many left and right turns she just made over the last mile.
While that sounds like a guaranteed crash in a car in the stock market, there is a distinct psychological logic to it. Humans are creatures of habit. Fear and greed are the two dominant emotions on Wall Street, and those emotions create recognizable, repeatable patterns.
Right, people panic the same way every time.
Exactly. Fiona isn't looking at the road ahead. She's looking for those recurring patterns in human behavior in the rearview mirror. But the core constraint you must remember for the exam is absolute. Technical analysts do not care about financials. They do not calculate intrinsic value. If a company cures a rare disease or sells pet rocks, it makes zero difference to Fiona. She trades the ticker symbol, not the company.
Okay, so Fiona is surfing the waves of human emotion. Let's wander over to patient Pete's world now. He's brewing his chamomile tea, adjusting his reading glasses. He represents fundamental analysis.
And Keith thinks Fiona is playing a dangerous game of musical chairs. Keith believes that the market is frequently irrational, deeply emotional, and frequently flat out wrong.
He thinks the herd is stupid.
Pretty much. He believes that a stock can be entirely mispriced by the market. It can be trading way too high overvalued or trading way too low undervalued.
So the glowing red price on Fiona's screen might say the stock is trading at $50.
Yeah.
But Pete does his own rigorous math and concludes, no, based on their actual cash flow, this company is actually worth $70.
Right. And that true underlying worth that $70 is what we call the intrinsic value. Fundamental analysis is the pursuit of finding that intrinsic value by rolling up your sleeves, ignoring the daily market noise, and digging into the financial statements. Pete is analyzing the income statement to track revenue growth and profit margins. He's scouring the balance sheet to weigh the hard assets against the liabilities.
So if Fiona is driving by looking in the rearview mirror, Pete is the guy who pulled the car over to the side of the road. He's got the hood popped open. He's studying the engine block. He's checking the oil viscosity. He's calculating the fuel efficiency. And he's looking at the topographic map of the mountains ahead.
Exactly. And because he's doing that level of deep structural research, his time horizon is naturally long term. I mean, you don't spend 3 weeks building a complex fundamental cash flow model just to hold a stock for 45 minutes.
Right. That'd be crazy.
You do it to buy and hold the stock for years, waiting patiently for the irrational market to eventually wake up, realize its mistake, and for the stock price to slowly rise to meet your calculated $70 intrinsic value.
All right, listen up. I'm breaking the fourth wall with you right now.
Oh.
This is where the exam tries to set a trap and steal your points.
Oh, yeah, they love this one.
The test writers know that you are cramming a massive amount of vocabulary into your head. They know the lines get blurry, so they are going to deliberately mix up Fiona's toolbox and Pete's toolbox to see if you are actually paying attention.
It is arguably the most common pitfall in this entire section of the Series 65. They will construct a detailed scenario and pepper it with a mix of vocabulary words just to see if you take the bait.
Right, so they're going to describe an analyst who is researching a company. They'll say this analyst is looking at the 50-day moving average, analyzing support levels, and tracking heavy trading volume. And then they'll ask, what type of analysis is this? Or even sneakier, they'll slip one fundamental term into a long list of technical terms, like the analyst is looking at price momentum, volume trends, moving averages, and the price-to-earnings ratio.
And you have to mentally separate these worlds instantly. The rule is rigid on the exam. If a question mentions charts, volume, moving averages, trend lines, or support and resistance, you are firmly in technical analysis territory. That's Fiona. Nope. If a question mentions financial statements, earnings, balance sheets, PE ratios, or intrinsic value, you are in fundamental analysis territory. That's Pete. Never let the two cross streams on the exam.
Okay, so time for a direct question for you, the listener. Think fast. You're reading a question that asks about an analyst reviewing a company's SEC filings, specifically their quarterly 10Q report. Are you channeling frantic Fiona or patient Pete?
Take a second. Who reads the 10Q?
Pete. Always Pete. Fiona wouldn't use a 10Q as a coaster for her espresso. It doesn't have any squiggly momentum lines or volume bars on it. SEC filings are the ultimate foundational data source for fundamental analysis.
And on the flip side, if the test question asks about a stock breaking out to a 52-week high on heavy trading volume, that is 100% Fiona. Pete might notice it on the evening news, but it has absolutely zero bearing on his calculation of the company's intrinsic value.
Okay, so we've established the philosophical divide. Let's actually open up these toolboxes and look at the gear inside. So Fiona can trade off these charts all she wants, but what exactly is she looking for? Let's dive into her specific tools.
The foundational concepts that drive almost all of technical analysis are support and resistance. Remember, Fiona is watching how humans react to price changes. So let's say she's watching a stock that's been sliding downward. But over the last 6 months, every single time the price hits $40, it suddenly stops dropping, turns around, and bounces back up.
Well,
it drops to 40 in January, bounces. Drops to 40 in March, bounces. That repeated $40 mark is what we call a support level.
So a support level is basically a price floor. But why does that floor even exist? It's not like the company suddenly becomes fundamentally better the second the stock hits exactly $40.
No, not at all. It's pure psychology and memory. Think about the market participants. There's a whole group of investors who watched the stock hit $40 previously, bounce up to 50, and they kick themselves for not buying at 40.
Oh, so they had FOMO, fear of missing out.
Exactly, classic FOMO. So they put in standing orders with their brokers. If this thing ever drops back to $40, buy it for me immediately. So when the price finally drifts back down to 40, all those latent buy orders trigger at once. The sudden surge in buying pressure overwhelms the selling pressure, and it acts like a physical floor, stopping the decline.
Oh, that makes so much sense. It's anchoring bias. And the exact opposite of that would be resistance, right? Let's say that same stock rallies up to $60, but then it stalls out, people start selling, and it falls back. It tries again a few months later, hits 60, and immediately gets knocked down again.
That is the resistance level. It's a price ceiling. And the psychology is the exact inverse of support. You have investors who bought at 60 right before it crashed down to 40. They've been holding the bag in absolute agony for months.
They just want out.
Yeah, they swear to themselves, if I can just get my money back, if the stock just gets back to my break even at 60, I'm selling everything and getting out. So the moment it touches 60, a massive wave of sell orders floods the market. That selling pressure stops the advance dead in its tracks.
Okay, so Fiona is watching this stock bounce back and forth. Support is like a trampoline at $40. The price falls, hits the trampoline of waiting buyers, and bounces up. Resistance is like a thick glass ceiling at $60. The price jumps up, smacks its head on the sellers at the glass ceiling, and falls back down. But here is the million-dollar question for a trader like Fiona. What happens if the momentum is so strong that it shatters the glass ceiling?
That moment is exactly what Fiona is waiting for, and it's a huge testable concept. When the price forcefully smashes through that resistance ceiling or violently falls through that support trampoline, technical analysts call it a breakout.
A breakout. So the stock price pushes past the $60 resistance and just keeps climbing into totally new territory.
Yes. But here is the critical exam caveat. A true, reliable breakout must be confirmed by high volume.
High volume. Okay.
Right. Volume is the total number of shares traded during that period. If the price breaks through the $60 resistance, but the volume is incredibly low, meaning only a few thousand shares traded hands, Fiona isn't trusted at all. It's likely a fake out or just a weird trap set by a few erratic trades. But if the price breaks through 60 and the trading volume is massive, millions upon millions of shares changing hands, that tells Fiona that major institutional money is behind the move.
Oh, so volume confirms the breakout. I love that. If one guy breaks through the glass ceiling, maybe it's just a fluke. Maybe he just had a really tall ladder. But if an entire army of millions of people smashes through the glass ceiling all at once, you know, the landscape has fundamentally changed. A new trend has officially started.
Exactly. Volume is the lie detector test for price movements.
Yep.
So that's support, resistance, and breakouts. The next major tool in Fiona's kit is the moving average.
Moving averages. Honestly, this has always sounded to me like math trying to masquerade as art. I've always found them a bit suspicious.
Really? How so?
Well, you're taking today's very real, very active, minute-by-minute price data, and you're deliberately diluting it by averaging it with prices from 200 days ago, back when the economy and the company might have been in a completely different situation.
Hmm.
Why would Fiona care about old news?
It's a fair critique, and it actually points to the fact that a moving average is a lagging indicator. It tells you what has happened, not what will happen.
Right.
But the reason Fiona uses them is because daily stock prices are incredibly chaotic and noisy. A stock might be up 2% today because of a random tweet, down 1% tomorrow, up 3% the next day. It's a jagged, erratic mess. A moving average strips out that daily noise by taking the average closing price over a set number of past days.
So it smooths it out.
Exactly. Yeah. Usually they use the 50-day moving average for short-term trends and the 200-day moving average for long-term trends.
So every single day at the market close, your software calculates the average price of the last 50 days and plots that as a single dot on the chart. Then you connect the dots over time and you get this smooth flowing line that completely ignores the daily hiccups and the random tweets.
Precisely. It shows you the broader underlying current of the river rather than the choppy waves on the surface. Is the smooth 200-day line generally pointing up or pointing down? But where it gets really interesting for the exam and for traders in general is when you overlay two different moving averages on the exact same chart, a short-term one like the 50-day and a long-term one, the 200-day.
Oh, I love this part because technical analysts give these events the most dramatic names possible. It's like they're writing a fantasy novel instead of trading stocks. Tell them about the crosses.
The Fiona is watching how these two smooth lines interact. If the short-term 50-day average line crosses above the long-term 200-day average line, it mathematically proves that recent near-term momentum is surging upwards significantly faster than the historical baseline trend. This is considered a highly bullish signal, a strong buy indicator. Technical analysts call it the golden cross.
The golden cross. Trumpets sound, angels sing, the stock is supposedly going to the moon.
That's the theory anyway. It signals a powerful new upward trend has solidified. But the inverse is also true. If the short-term 50-day average crosses below the long-term 200-day average, it means recent momentum is violently collapsing compared to the historical baseline. This is a highly bearish signal, a massive red flag to sell. They call this the death cross.
The death cross. So dramatic. But the logic totally tracks. If your recent 50-day performance is so terrible that it's dragging you down below your long-term 200-day average, the momentum isn't just slowing down, it's completely dead.
Correct. The golden cross is Fiona's green light to buy. The death cross is her blaring siren to sell or short the stock.
Okay, so we have the psychological trampoline glass ceiling, we have the volume confirming breakouts, and we have the dramatic moving averages. Now we need to talk about the actual physical shapes Fiona is looking for on her charts, chart patterns. And listener, I want to ring the alarm bell right now because there's a massive, incredibly common exam gotcha hidden in this specific section.
Oh, absolutely. The test writers absolutely love to test your ability to categorize chart patterns. They aren't going to give you a blank piece of paper and make you draw one, but they will give you the name of a pattern in a multiple choice question and expect you to know exactly what it implies for the future price.
Let's start with the most famous one in the entire technical lexicon, the head and shoulders pattern. Walk us through what this looks like, and more importantly, the psychology of why it happens.
Visually, imagine a line graph tracking a stock's price that forms three distinct peaks. The first peak goes up during a strong rally, hits resistance, and comes down that forms the left shoulder. The bulls regroup and push the price up even higher, forming a massive second peak that towers over the first, but then it sells off again. That's the head.
Okay, got the head.
Finally, the buyers try one last time to rally, forming a third peak, but this time they are weak. The third peak only goes about as high as the first peak, failing to reach anywhere near the height of the head, and then it rolls over and drops. That's the right shoulder.
So it literally traces the silhouette of a person's head and shoulders on the chart. But why should I care? What is the psychology behind that right shoulder failing?
It represents a brutal psychological tug of war where the buyers finally collapse from sheer exhaustion. The head was a massive surge of greed, hitting a new all-time high, but the right shoulder is the critical tell. The bulls tried to push it back to that new high, but they failed miserably.
They ran out of steam.
Exactly. The buying power in the market is fundamentally depleted. The sellers realize the upward momentum is completely dead, panic sets in, and it triggers a massive sell-off. Therefore, the head and shoulders pattern is a major reversal signal. Specifically, it signals a reversal from a bullish trend prices going up to a bearish trend prices going down.
It's a reversal. The party's officially over. The lights are on. It's time to go home.
Yes. And you should know, you can also have an inverse head and shoulders, which is just the exact same psychology flipped upside down at the bottom of a downtrend. Three troughs, with the middle one being the deepest, that signals the sellers are exhausted, and it reverses from bearish to bullish.
Okay, so head and shoulders means reversal. What about double tops and double bottoms?
Same underlying concept of exhaustion. A double top is two peaks at roughly the exact same price level. The stock rallied, hit resistance, fell, rallied again, and smacked into that exact same resistance ceiling a second time and failed. It proves the ceiling is too thick to break. It's a reversal signal indicating the price is about to drop.
Makes sense.
And a double bottom is just two troughs hitting the exact same support trampoline. The sellers tried to push it lower twice and failed. It's a reversal signal indicating the price is about to rise.
Okay, so head and shoulders, double top, double bottom, all of these mean the current trend is dying and reversing course. The train has hit the end of the line and is turning around. Now, what about the cup and handle?
Ah, this is where the trap is set for the unwary test taker. Visually, the cup and handle pattern looks exactly like a teacup viewed from the side on a chart. The price drops, rounds out in a nice wide U-shaped basin over several months, comes back up to the original starting level that forms the cup.
Okay, and the handle.
Then, instead of breaking out immediately, it pulls back slightly, forming a small, gentle downward slope that's the handle.
And here is the mega exam trap, explicitly flagged for you listening right now. Do whatever you need to do to memorize this. Candidates confuse reversals and continuations all the time under pressure. The exam will ask you which of the following is a continuation pattern, and they will list head and shoulders, double top, double bottom, and cup and handle.
A continuation pattern is completely different from a reversal. It means the stock is just taking a brief, healthy pause to consolidate its gains before continuing in its original direction. The cup and handle is a classic bullish continuation pattern. The handle is just the last few weak sellers leaving the market. After the handle finishes forming, the price is expected to break out upwards, continuing the prior upward trend powerfully.
So let me prompt you directly, listener. You are staring at your screen in the testing center. You see a question describing an analyst who spots a head and shoulders pattern forming on a stock chart. Based solely on this pattern, is the stock about to keep going up, or is it about to take a massive dive? Take a second. Head and shoulder.
It's taking a dive. The buyers are exhausted. It is a reversal pattern, bullish to bearish.
If you mix up head and shoulders with cup and handle on the exam, you lose an easy point. Head and shoulders reverses the trend. Cup and handle continues the trend. Say it out loud to yourself three times when you walk the dog later. It is that crucial.
It really is a classic, predictable test writer's trick to put those two next to each other in the multiple choice options just to see if you panic.
All right, so Fiona can trade her patterns all day.
Mm-hmm.
But here is why Patient Pete thinks she is totally missing the plot. What if the company behind that stock ticker is actually committing massive accounting fraud? Think about Enron. Enron probably had amazing charts and huge volume breakouts right up until the moment it went completely bankrupt.
They absolutely did.
A chart cannot tell you if a business is secretly rotting from the inside out. If you want to hold a stock for a decade, you can't just look at squiggly lines. You have to open the hood and look at the engine. And that brings us to Patient Pete's spreadsheets. We are transitioning into fundamental valuation metrics.
Pete doesn't give a damn about a golden cross. He wants cold, hard facts. He wants to know exactly what the company owns, what debt it owes, and how much actual profit it earns. We are diving into the financial statements to find that elusive, mathematical, intrinsic value.
Let's start with the absolute most basic building block of fundamental analysis, EPS, earnings per share. Now, listener, since you are prepping for the 65, you probably already know the basic definition.
Right. The formula is straightforward. You take the total profit of the company, the net income, from the very bottom of the income statement and divide it by the number of common shares outstanding in the market. It tells you exactly how much actual money the company made for every single share of stock you own.
So if a company makes $10 million in net income and they have 10 million shares outstanding, the EPS is $1 per share. But here is where we need to elevate this beyond a 101 finance class. The exam isn't just going to ask the formula. It's going to test if you understand how companies can legally manipulate that EPS number to look better than they actually are. For instance, what happens when a company does massive share buybacks?
This is a brilliant nuance to bring up. Let's say that same company still only makes $10 million in net income. The business hasn't grown at all. Their profit is completely flat. But the CEO decides to use cash to buy back 5 million of their own shares and retire them. Suddenly, you are dividing that same $10 million profit by only 5 million shares. The EPS magically jumps from $1 per share to $2 per share.
The profit didn't change, the underlying business didn't improve one bit, but the EPS doubled. Fiona wouldn't notice, but Patient Pete has to spot that accounting trick. He has to realize the EPS growth is a mirage created by financial engineering, not actual business growth.
Exactly. And Pete also knows that EPS by itself, even if it's perfectly accurate, doesn't tell you if the stock is cheap or expensive to buy right now. To know if you are getting a good deal, you must compare that EPS to the actual price the stock is trading at in the open market.
Which brings us to the granddaddy of all valuation metrics, the PE ratio, the price to earnings ratio.
The PE ratio formula is simple but profound. Take the current market price per share and divide it by the earnings per share. So if a stock is trading at $20 a share and its EPS is $1, the PE ratio is 20.
Okay, let's unpack this with an analogy because PE can feel a bit abstract when you just look at the raw numbers. A PE of 20 is basically like paying $20 today to buy a magic goose that lays one single golden egg worth $1 every year.
I like that. The market price is what you pay out of pocket for the goose today. The EPS is the golden egg it lays for you annually.
Right. So if I pay $20 for a goose that lays a $1 egg, and it never lays more than one, it is going to take me exactly 20 years of collecting eggs just to break even on my initial purchase. That's what a PE of 20 means in plain English. Investors are willing to pay $20 for every $1 of current earnings.
And this is where Pete really starts doing his comparative analysis because the market isn't uniform. Why would an investor look at a different company, say, a hot new tech startup, and gladly pay $50 for a goose that only lays a $1 egg, a PE of 50? That means it takes 50 years of current earnings just to break even. On paper, that seems financially insane.
Unless you expect that specific tech goose to start laying a lot more eggs very soon.
Precisely. A higher PE ratio indicates that investors have massive growth expectations for the future. They are perfectly willing to pay a massive premium today because they believe that $1 of earnings is going to rapidly grow to $2, then $5, then $10 in the near future.
So they're pricing in future perfection.
Right. These are typically your high-flying growth stocks. Think about NVIDIA in 2023 riding the AI wave, trading at a PE well over 100 at times. People weren't paying for today's earnings. They were paying for tomorrow's expected dominance.
But Pete is historically a value guy. He might look at a tech stock with a PE of 80 and say, that's absurdly overvalued. The market is way too optimistic about this goose's future fertility. If they miss their earnings target by a single penny, the stock will crater.
Right. Pete is often hunting for the opposite. He is looking for a lower PE ratio. A low PE might indicate a value stock. The market has very low growth expectations for it, or maybe the company is currently out of favor because of a temporary scandal or a cyclical downturn. Think of a legacy automaker like Ford, which often trades at a PE of 6 or 8. Pete might look at that and think, hey, The market is undervaluing these steady, reliable earnings. I can buy this goose for only $6, and it still gives me a dollar every year.
So to summarize the exam takeaway, a significantly higher PE equals high growth expectations, but also a huge risk of overvaluation if they don't deliver. A lower PE equals low growth expectations, but flags potential undervaluation.
Got it. So that covers the income statement side of things, the earnings. Let's flip over to the balance sheet. Let's talk about book value.
Book value completely ignores the earnings. It is all about the net assets. Imagine a nightmare scenario where the company suddenly stopped operating today, fired everyone, sold every single factory, patent, and desk it earned at fair accounting value, and used that cash to pay off every single bond and debt it owed.
A total liquidation.
Exactly. The cash left over in the briefcase at the very end of the day is the book value. It's what is left over for the shareholders.
Okay, walk us through the exact formula for book value per share, because I know there is a massive trap hiding in it. You start at the top. You take total assets. You subtract total liabilities. That gives you the net worth. But then, and this is the crucial step they test on the exam this week, you must subtract the value of the preferred stock. You take whatever number is left after that, and you divide it by the common shares outstanding.
Wait, hold up. I'm stopping you right there.
Yeah.
Total assets minus total liabilities makes perfect intuitive sense to me. That's just what you own minus what you owe. Basic accounting. But why on earth do we subtract preferred stock before we divide it up for the common shareholders? What did the preferred stockholders do to deserve getting their money carved out first?
It entirely comes down to the legal hierarchy of priority and liquidation. Let's use a sinking ship analogy, because bankruptcy is basically a sinking ship.
Okay, I'm with you.
If the company goes bankrupt, the bondholders, the banks, and the creditors get the first lifeboats. They are legally entitled to get paid back first. That's why we subtract the total liabilities. But then, who gets the very next round of lifeboats? The preferred shareholders. They have a legally superior priority claim over the common shareholders.
Ugh. So the common shareholders are just the unfortunate souls standing on the wet, slanted deck in the freezing rain, waiting to see if there are literally any lifeboats left after everyone else is evacuated.
That is a grim but completely accurate picture of equity risk. Book value per common share is trying to figure out exactly how much value is left for those specific people shivering on the wet deck. So you absolutely must deduct the par value of the preferred stock first, because that specific value does not belong to the common shareholders. They only get the residual, what's left over at the very, very end.
That makes perfect sense when you visualize it like that. Okay, so now Pete has done the math, and he has this book value per share number. Let's say he calculates it to be $10 per share. He is going to take that metric and compare it to the current market price, right? Just like he did with the PE ratio.
Exactly. This creates the price to book ratio, or PB ratio. You take the market price per share and divide it by the book value per share.
Here's where it gets incredibly fascinating from an investment strategy perspective. What happens if a company has a price-to-book ratio of less than 1? Let's say it's 0.8.
If the PD ratio is less than 1, it means a bizarre inefficiency has occurred. The stock is currently trading in the open market for less than its literal accounting book value. The market is pricing the entire company at less than the net value of its actual physical assets.
So mechanically speaking, if the PB is 0.8, you could theoretically orchestrate a corporate raid. You could buy every single outstanding share of the entire company, immediately shut the business down, sell all its factories, real estate, and office chairs on the open market, pay off all the creditors, and you would walk away with a guaranteed 20% profit just from liquidating it.
Theoretically, yes. That is the ultimate old-school value investor's dream, made famous by guys like Benjamin Graham. You are basically buying a dollar for 80 cents.
But there's a catch, right?
Oh, there is always a catch. In the real world, you have to be incredibly careful. A PB less than 1 often signals a value trap. It means the market is highly skeptical of the company's accounting. Maybe those factories are totally obsolete and couldn't actually be sold for their stated accounting value. Or maybe the company's burning so much cash every quarter that the book value is rapidly shrinking while you watch. But Pete will dig into those details to see if the market is irrationally overreacting to bad news.
So a PB less than 1 is a massive flashing neon sign that says potential undervaluation. But you have to verify the assets are actually real.
Yes. And it is vital to note for the exam that the PB ratio is most useful for asset-heavy industries. Think regional banks, real estate investment trusts, or heavy industrial manufacturing. Companies that own a lot of tangible, easily valued stuff. It is virtually useless for a modern software company whose main assets are proprietary code and the brains of their developers, none of which show up neatly as assets on a traditional balance sheet.
Okay, one final metric in Pete's spreadsheet before we move on. The dividend payout ratio.
This is a simple but incredibly telling metric regarding management's view of the future. It is simply the dividends per share divided by the earnings per share. It tells you exactly what percentage of the company's net profit is being mailed out to shareholders as cash dividends versus what percentage is being kept inside the company.
So if a company earns $2 a share in EPS and they pay a $1 dividend, the payout ratio is 50%.
Correct. And this tells a story. A very high payout ratio, like 80 or 90%, tells you the company is fully mature, they dominate their market, they have nowhere left to rapidly expand, so instead of wasting money on doomed growth projects, they are returning almost all their profits to the owners. Utility companies are classic examples.
The low one.
Conversely, a low payout ratio, like 10% or a 0% payout, tells you the company is in an aggressive growth phase. They are retaining all their earnings to build new factories, hire more engineers, or acquire competitors.
Which perfectly transitions us to our third character in this saga. Because while Patient Pete is happily sitting there calculating payout ratios and book values, Dividend Dave just aggressively kicked down the door to the study.
Here comes Dave.
Dave doesn't care about the payout ratio. He doesn't care about the retained earnings. He just wants the actual cash in his hand today. This brings us to Dividend Dave's mailbox money.
Dividend Dave introduces us to our first formal absolute valuation model, the Dividend Discount Model, or DDM.
Dave is sitting on his front porch, arms crossed, waiting for the mail carrier to arrive. He looks at Pete and Fiona and says, "I don't care about your hypothetical asset liquidation value, Pete. I don't care about your golden moving average crosses, Fiona. You cannot buy groceries at the supermarket with a golden cross, and you cannot pay your electric bill with a high book value. Show me the cash."
Dave has a very strict, uncompromising philosophy. A stock is only worth the present value of all the future cash checks it will actually mail to you, period. The DDM values a stock strictly as the present value of all expected future dividends discounted back to today.
I always think of this like evaluating real estate. Let's say Dave is looking at buying a rental house. Dave completely ignores the paint color. He ignores the school district ratings. He ignores what the comparable houses in the neighborhood sold for yesterday. He purely looks at the lease agreement. He says, "This house pays $1,000 a month in rent. I want an 8% return on my money. What is that specific stream of rent checks worth to me today?" That is exactly how the DDM works for stocks.
That is a perfect analogy because it highlights the major limitation of the model. Because it relies entirely and exclusively on dividends, the DDM is really only applicable to a very specific type of company. You use it for stable, mature, highly predictable dividend payers, utility companies, massive legacy blue chip stocks, consumer staples.
So no tech startups.
Absolutely not. You cannot use the DDM on a fast-growing tech startup that reinvests all its cash and has never paid a dividend in its life because the math simply won't work. The numerator of the equation is zero, so the value is zero.
So let's look at the math. The most basic zero growth formula is just the dividend divided by the required rate of return, D divided by R. So if Dave wants a 5% return on his investments, and he's looking at a utility stock that pays a flat $2 dividend every year, it's 2 divided by 0.05, which equals 40 bucks. Dave will pay exactly 40 bucks for that stock. If it trades at 45, he won't buy it. If it trades at 35, he buys it instantly.
Exactly. It gives him an absolute ceiling on the price. But the real world isn't entirely static, is it? Inflation exists. What if the utility company is allowed to raise its rates, and so it increases its dividend by a tiny bit every single year to keep up with inflation?
Ah, enter the Gordon growth model. This always sounds to me like a guy you'd meet wearing a sweater tied around his neck at a country club. Hello, I'm Gordon Growth.
It does sound like a person.
But it's actually just the formal name for the constant growth dividend discount model.
Yes. The Gordon growth model adds a necessary layer of complexity. It assumes that the dividend isn't flat, but that it will grow at a constant predictable percentage rate forever into eternity.
Okay, let's break down the variables for the listener very clearly, because this formula is guaranteed to show up. The formula is stock value equals D1. Divided by the quantity of R minus G. What do these specific letters actually represent?
Okay, D1 is next year's expected dividend, not today's, next year's. R is your required rate of return, also known as the discount rate. And G is the assumed constant annual growth rate of a dividend.
So D1 divided by R minus G. Now hold up. Put down your coffee, stop the treadmill, listen to me right now. This is critical. The exam writers are absolutely vicious when it comes to testing the Gordon growth model. There are two mega traps here that destroy test scores. Let's expose them so our listeners don't fall for them. Trap number one, the model breaking.
This is a mathematical absolute, and you have to understand why it happens. The Gordon growth model breaks down completely and becomes utterly useless if the estimated growth rate, G, is greater than or equal to your required rate of return, R.
Explain the why here. Don't just give me the rule. Why does the math literally explode?
Look at the denominator of the formula R minus G. Let's say your required return, R, is 5%, and the company's dividend growth rate, G, is also 5%. What is 5 minus 5?
Zero.
And as we all learned in middle school math, you cannot divide a number by zero. It is mathematically undefined. The equation shoots off to infinity.
And what if the growth rate is actually bigger than the return? What if R is 5% and the company is growing at 7%?
Then 5 minus 7 is negative 2. You divide the dividend by a negative number and the formula spits out a result telling you the stock has a negative value, which is physically impossible in the real world. A stock cannot be worth negative dollars. Philosophically, if a company's dividend grows faster than the discount rate forever, its value eventually consumes the entire global economy. It's just a mathematical glitch.
So the ironclad rule for the exam is R must always be strictly greater than G. If it's not, the model cannot be applied. So, listener, let me prompt you directly with a scenario. Imagine this exact test question. Dividend Dave is analyzing his favorite utility stock. His required rate of return is 5%. The company's projected constant dividend growth rate is 6%. The dividend is $2. What is the Gordon growth intrinsic value of the stock?
Take a second. Run the numbers in your head. What's the value?
It's a trick question. It's a massive trap. The growth rate is 6. The return is 5. G is greater than R. The formula breaks. The correct answer on the multiple choice list will usually be something like the model cannot be applied or mathematically undefined. Do not try to force the math. Divide by negative 1 and pick a negative dollar amount. You will get it wrong.
That is trap one, and it tests your conceptual understanding of the model's limits. Now let's discuss trap two. This one is even sneakier because it tests your attention to detail. It's the battle of D0 versus D1.
The subscript letters. My absolute nemesis in finance.
Remember, the official Gordon growth formula uses D1 as the numerator. D1 is next year's expected dividend. But the test writers are deliberately tricky. They will often give you D0 in the word problem, which is the dividend the company just paid in the past.
Oh, that's evil. So the word problem will literally say the company just paid a dividend of $2 today. That's D0. It's already happened.
Exactly. And if you are rushing and you plug that $2 directly into the top of the formula and run the math, you will get a very specific wrong answer. And I guarantee you, with 100% certainty, the test writers will have that exact wrong answer sitting there as choice A, waiting for you to click it with a false sense of confidence.
So how do we fix it? How do we defensively turn D0 into D1 before we run the main equation?
You have to mathematically grow it by exactly 1 year. You take D0, the $2, and multiply it by 1 plus the growth rate, so 1 plus G. So if the growth rate in the problem is 5%, you multiply $2 by $1 or 5. That gives you $2.10. That new number, $2.10, is your D1. That is the actual number you must plug into the top of the Gordon growth formula.
So the entire trap hinges on reading comprehension. If the question explicitly says next year's expected dividend is, yeah, you are good to go. That's already D1. Just use it. But if the question says the company recently paid, the company just paid, or the current dividend is, yeah, you must immediately hit the pause button in your brain, multiply by 1 plus G to find D1, and then and only then execute the formula.
You have to read DDM questions incredibly carefully. Every single word matters. It is a reading test disguised as a math test.
Okay, so Dividend Dave is happy. We found a mathematical way to value his steady, slow-growth, dividend-paying utility stocks. But Dave's model has a catastrophic blind spot in the modern economy. What if we want to value Amazon in the year 2005, or Google, or a cutting-edge biotech startup that is pouring every cent back into research? They don't pay dividends. Dave's strict model says they're worth exactly $0, but obviously Amazon wasn't worth zero, so we need a bigger, broader, much more powerful tool. And that brings us to the final concept, the ultimate valuation machine. Discounted cash flow or DCF?
DCF is the heavy artillery of fundamental analysis. It is the absolute gold standard used by investment banks and private equity. It is the most comprehensive valuation tool because it completely frees us from relying on management's decision to pay a dividend. It relies on free cash flow instead.
Free cash flow.
Yeah.
Let's define that simply. It is the actual physical cash the business generates from its core operations. After paying for all necessary capital expenditures like maintaining their factories or servers, regardless of whether they mail that cash to Dave or keep it locked in a corporate bank account.
Exactly. It's the cash that is theoretically free to be distributed to owners if they chose to do so. Because of that, DCF can be applied to any company, anywhere, in any industry, dividend or no dividend. The core underlying principle that makes DCF work is the time value of money. A dollar you receive next year is fundamentally worth less than a dollar you hold in your hand today.
Right. And we need to explain why that is, because it's the heartbeat of finance. If I have a dollar today, I have opportunity, I can put it in a risk-free treasury bill, earn some interest, and next year I'll have a dollar and 5 cents. Furthermore, a dollar promised to me next year carries risk. What if the person goes bankrupt and doesn't pay me? Plus, inflation will eat away its purchasing power. So a future dollar is inherently, unavoidably, less valuable. We have to mathematically discount it back to figure out what its equivalent value is today.
That is the flawless essence of the model. DCF attempts to project every single dollar of free cash flow a company will generate from now until the end of time. It then discounts each of those future dollars back to what they're worth today, using a specific discount rate that accounts for risk and time, and then it adds them all up into one giant sum. That massive sum is the true intrinsic value of the company.
So how do we visualize this? Think of DCF like trying to estimate the true value of an apple orchard you want to buy. You don't just count the apples hanging on the trees today. To know what the orchard is really worth, you have to calculate how many apples it will grow next year and the year after that and the year after that. But a promised apple 10 years from now isn't worth as much to you as an apple you can eat today. There's the risk of a bad harvest, a drought, or pests.
Right, so you apply a discount.
Exactly. You mentally discount the value of those future apples, you add up the discounted value of all future harvests, and that tells you what you should pay for the entire orchard today.
That is a brilliant way to conceptualize it. The further out in the future the harvest is, the heavier the discount you apply, and the less those future apples contribute to the price you are willing to pay today. A harvest projected in year 30 is heavily discounted. Its present value today is almost negligible.
Okay, but the apple orchard analogy brings up a logistical nightmare for patient Pete. You said DCF projects cash flows until the end of time. How on earth does an analyst sitting in an office in New York predict what a company's free cash flow will be in the year 2085?
They don't. That would be an exercise in pure fiction. And this brings us to the actual structure of a real-world DCF model, which is split into two very distinct parts: the explicit forecast period and the terminal value.
Let's break those two chunks down, because the exam will ask about the structure.
Analysts will explicitly project cash flows year by year for a relatively short window, typically 5 to 10 years. They'll build a massive spreadsheet. Year one free cash flow is projected to be this. Year two is this, building up to year 10. They do this because over a 5 to 10 year horizon, you can make highly educated, reasonable assumptions about industry trends, market share, and the broader economy.
Okay, so they do the grueling, detailed accounting math for the first decade. But what about everything after year 10? The company doesn't just spontaneously vaporize on year 11.
Right. To capture the remaining value of the company from year 11 stretching into infinity, they use a massive mathematical shortcut called the terminal value. They take the cash flow from that final explicitly projected year 10, and they apply the Gordon growth model to it. They assume that from year 11 onward, the company will just grow at a steady conservative rate, roughly tracking GDP, forever. They bundle all of eternity into one single massive number.
Terminal value. It's just the Gordon growth model wearing a trench coat. And here is the exam trap for this specific concept. How much of the total company value does this one single terminal value number usually represent?
This shocks people, but the terminal value is usually the absolute largest component of a DCF valuation. It routinely makes up 60 to 80% and sometimes even more of the total calculated intrinsic value of the business.
Think about the insanity of that for a second. Patient Pete does all this intense, granular, 100-page spreadsheet work to predict the next 10 years,
yep,
and it only accounts for 20% of the company's value. The other 80% is just a giant mathematical shortcut for the rest of time.
And because that terminal value shortcut uses the Gordon growth model, which relies on R minus G in the denominator tiny, microscopic changes in the discount rate or the assumed long-term growth rate can swing that terminal value wildly. A mere 1% tweak in your assumptions about the year 2040 can mathematically add or erase billions of dollars in valuation today.
That is slightly terrifying, and it really explains why stock prices are so volatile.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've got the explicit period and the terminal value. Let's talk about the key relationships, the cause and effect rules that the exam writers obsess over. You mentioned the discount rate. Let's drill deeply into that.
The exam will constantly test your fundamental understanding of how shifting variables impact the final valuation. The first rule is intuitive. Higher expected future cash flows equal a higher present intrinsic value. More money coming in the future is better. But the relationship with the discount rate, the required rate of return, is an inverse relationship.
I call this the seesaw effect. Picture a playground seesaw. On one side, sitting on the seat, you have the discount rate, which is heavily influenced by current interest rates. On the other side, sitting on the opposite seat, you have the intrinsic value of the stock.
If the discount rate goes UP, the intrinsic value of the stock must go down and N. And if the discount rate goes down N, the intrinsic value goes UP. They are mathematically locked into moving in opposite directions.
Let's ground this in recent history. Why did high growth tech stocks get absolutely crushed in 2022? Because the Federal Reserve started aggressively raising interest rates. When the Fed raises rates, the risk-free rate goes up, which means every investor's required discount rate goes up. The seesaw tipped. The discount rate went up, so the present value of all those future tech earnings plummeted. This is the single most commonly tested sensitivity in DCF problems.
Let's do a direct listener prompt to cement this, because they have to know it instinctively.
Okay, listener, you're in the hot seat again. A test question describes a scenario where macroeconomic fears cause investors to demand a higher risk premium for investing in equities. Because of this, the required rate of return, or discount rate, goes up. According to the DCF model, does the valuation of the stock go up or does it go down? Take a beat. The discount rate went UP.
It goes down. The seesaw effect. A higher discount rate mathematically requires a lower present value. If you only remember one single mathematical relationship from this entire deep dive, make it that one.
Okay, so Pete has run his DCF. He discounted the explicit years, he calculated the massive terminal value, he added them together, and he's got his final massive number. But wait, he isn't quite done. The standard DCF usually gives us something called enterprise value. What is that, and why isn't it the final answer?
Enterprise value is the value of the entire business entity as a whole. It's essentially what it would cost a private equity firm to buy the company outright, assuming they take ownership of all the company's cash on hand, but also assume responsibility for paying off all the company's debts. But as a retail stock investor buying shares on an app, you don't want the enterprise value. You want the equity value per share.
So how do we get from the whole massive pie down to a single slice of equity? Walk us through the waterfall.
It's a two-step deduction process. First, you take the total enterprise value and you subtract the net debt. Net debt is their total outstanding debt minus whatever cash they have in the bank. You have to subtract this because, legally, you have to pay off the bondholders and the banks before the equity shareholders have a claim to anything. Once you subtract that net debt from the enterprise value, you are left with the total equity value.
And step two to get the final price tag.
You take that total equity value and simply divide it by the total number of common shares outstanding in the market. That finally, at long last, gives you the intrinsic value per share. That is the final dollar amount that patient Pete will compare to the glowing red market price on Fiona's screen to decide if he wants to buy.
Incredible. We've gone from the big picture down to the exact dollar per share. So before we wrap up this massive section, let's do a final crystal clear comparison between Dividend Dave's DDM and patient Pete's DCF. Because structurally they look similar, they both discount future cash, but the exam expects you to instantly know the difference based on the wording.
The easiest mental framework is that DDM is just a highly specific, much narrower subcategory of DCF. DDM uses only dividends as the cash flow variable. DCF uses the entire free cash flow of the business.
So if a test question says an analyst is using a model that calculates the present value of future dividends, you immediately select DDM. If the question says an analyst is using a model that calculates the present value of all future cash flows available to the firm, you select DCF. DCF is the big umbrella. DDM is just one specific person standing under the umbrella holding a dividend check.
Exactly. DDM is for your stable dividend payers, DCF is for any company, including non-dividend payers. It's entirely a question of scope.
Wow. We have covered a truly massive amount of ground today. We've hung out with frantic Fiona, trying to surf the waves of human emotion with her charts. We sat with patient Pete doing accounting gymnastics in his spreadsheets, and we watched Dividend Dave demanding cash at his mailbox. It is time for the outro. We're going to do a rapid-fire recap to cement all these concepts in your short-term memory before exam day. I'll take one, you take the next. Ready?
Ready? Let's lock this in.
Number one, technical analysis. This is frantic Fiona. It only looks at price history, momentum, and volume. It completely, utterly ignores fundamentals, earnings, and SEC filings.
Number two, chart patterns. Head and Shoulders is a reversal pattern from a bullish uptrend to a bearish downtrend driven by buyer exhaustion. Cup and Handle is a continuation pattern. Do not mix them up on test day.
Number three, fundamental analysis. This is patient Pete. It tries to find the true intrinsic value using financial statements. A high PE ratio means the market has huge growth expectations. A low PE means it might be a value stock.
Number four, the Gordon growth model breaks down mathematically and is useless if the projected growth rate, G, is greater than or equal to the required rate of return, R. It becomes undefined.
Number five, the D0 versus D1 trap. If the problem says the dividend was just paid or recently paid, that is D0, you must multiply it by 1 plus G to find next year's D1 before you execute the Gordon formula.
Number six, discounted cash flow or DCF is the broadest, most powerful tool. It covers any company, even those without dividends, by relying on free cash flow. DDM is only applicable to stable dividend payers.
Number seven, the seesaw effect. A higher discount rate always means a lower present value. If the Fed raises interest rates, your required return goes up and the intrinsic value goes down.
And finally, number eight, terminal value. It captures all cash flows beyond the initial 5 to 10 year forecast period, and it is usually the largest component of a DCF valuation, often accounting for 60 to 80% of the total calculated value.
Boom. That is high yield series 65 gold right there. If you understand the why behind those 8 points, you are going to crush this section.
But before we officially sign off, I want to leave you with a final, somewhat provocative thought to ponder. We just spent a lot of time talking about how patient Pete uses his complex DCF models to calculate a stock's so-called intrinsic value with intense, seemingly objective mathematical precision.
Right. The 100-page spreadsheets, the exact discount rates, the 10-year cash flow forecasts, it feels very scientific.
But think about this critically. If the terminal value makes up 80% of a company's worth, and that terminal value completely relies on predicting a steady growth rate decades into the unseen future, are fundamental analysts really doing objective math? Or are they just making highly educated, mathematically disguised guesses about a distant future they can't possibly know? It makes you wonder if patient Pete and frantic Fiona are actually just playing two slightly different versions of the exact same guessing game, just using different costumes. Food for thought for your next study session.
Oh, man. Pulling the rug of certainty out right at the very end. I love it. Are Wall Street's complex spreadsheets just horoscopes with numbers? We will let you, the listener, decide that for yourself. Keep drilling those practice questions. Understand the why behind the math. Keep your head in the game, and we will see you on the next deep dive.